This morning, State of Washington versus Sylvia Knopp.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Jennifer Swigert here on behalf of Ms. Sylvia Knopp, the appellant. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Very well.
Ms. Knopp never denied taking and using her mother's money. Under the durable power of attorney agreement, she had the authority to reimburse herself for services that she would have otherwise had to pay someone to do for her mother. Now, the state's proof in this case failed in 2 ways. First, the state failed to prove that Ms. Knopp intended to deprive her mother or appropriated these funds to anyone else's use. Second, the state failed to disprove her affirmative defense of good faith claim of title. Additionally, the jury's verdict was tainted by unfair closing argument by the prosecutor that misstated the law pertaining to both the elements of the offense and the affirmative defense. And her counsel was ineffective in failing to object to these misstatements of the law. We therefore ask this court to reverse her conviction. The evidence is insufficient to show 2 of the essential elements of guilt, specifically the intent to deprive and that she appropriated these funds to someone else's use. She's certainly guilty of not being particularly good at being a durable power of attorney for her mother. Obviously, we can't dispute the failure to provide a detailed accounting, the certainly arguable poor judgment in refusing to pay disputed nursing home bills. But in this informal setting of a family where you have a mother caring for, a daughter caring for an aging mother, more should be required to prove that she actually misappropriated these funds. Additionally, regarding the good faith claim of title defense, under State v. Ager, what's required is some good faith basis to believe that this her use of the funds was authorized. The durable power of attorney, as well as her own attorney's advice that she was authorized to reimburse herself for services that she would otherwise have had to hire out, is a basis for that good faith belief. And the state failed to refute that, so we would argue there's insufficient evidence. However, in order to convince the jury, despite these valid reasons for doubt, the prosecutor relied on misstatements of the law. The state has not disputed in their briefing that...
Let me ask you, with regard to the sufficiency of the evidence, there was substantial evidence that she was spending a considerable amount of time in gambling casinos, and that some of the withdrawals, a number of the withdrawals that were made, were made from a casino or... At least in time proximity, fairly close to the time that she was at the casino. Did that not constitute at least some significant circumstantial evidence that the money was being used for something other than caring for a mother?
We would argue that it does not, because there was also evidence that she had sufficient income of her own to cover the gambling losses that she sustained. But even if this court finds that to be sufficient evidence, her conviction should still be reversed for the misstatements of the law during closing argument and her attorney's failure to object. The state's conceded that theft requires more than simply a breach of a fiduciary duty or unreasonable judgment in terms of using the money. Theft requires the actual intent to deprive. And yet throughout the closing argument, the prosecutor repeatedly argued that her breach of this fiduciary duty was itself criminal. And I want to make clear that what the prosecutor was not arguing that somehow this was really bad because she was stealing from someone whom she had a fiduciary duty to. And the prosecutor was also not arguing that this was a credibility question, that because her judgment was unreasonable, you somehow shouldn't believe her. The statements that are in the argument are specifically saying breach of this fiduciary duty is a crime. Repeatedly, I would refer the court to page 1015 of the closing argument. The prosecutor actually stated that twice. At page 1030, the state argued that the question of appropriating the money to someone else's use, which is the definition of exerting unauthorized control, comes down to the priorities of reimbursing herself before paying the nursing home. That's the kind of...
If counsel had objected, then counsel likely would have got an instruction to the jury as to what the correct law was on that issue. And in which case, what would the prejudice have been had the jury been properly instructed?
Well, if this court finds that the error was not preserved because it could have been cured by objection, then we definitely argue that her counsel was ineffective in failing to object. It's deficient performance because defense counsel raised this good faith claim of title defense that negates her intent, and yet just sat there while the state repeatedly argued essentially that her intent didn't matter, that if her judgment was unreasonable in breaching the fiduciary duty that she had, then she was automatically guilty of theft, and in arguing repeatedly that the good faith claim of title defense didn't even apply, when that's simply not true. I would point the court to State v. Ager at page 92. The court says, this defense negates the element of intent to steal by providing that a defendant cannot be guilty of theft if the defendant takes property from another under the good faith belief that he is the owner or entitled to the possession of the property. Now, the prosecutor was arguing that good faith claim of title means a title, like title to a car or some specific item, and it can't refer to just a fungible thing like money that you might be entitled to. And State v. Ager says exactly the opposite.
Your argument is under this circumstance, it certainly can.
It certainly can.
She's got a power of attorney that entitles her to take that money so long as she uses it for the proper purposes.
Exactly.
Okay.
And that's exactly what the issue was in State v. Ager as well. In that case, these were directors of an insurance company who took advances. And the court said that if there had been some statement by the directors or some past practice that they might have interpreted as authorizing those advances, then they would have established the good faith claim of title defense. And that's what we have here. We have this durable power of attorney agreement. We also have her own attorney's advice to her that she could use this money to reimburse herself for things that she would otherwise.
What about the money that was taken after the court orders had been issued, prohibiting her from taking that money?
Your Honor, that only shows exactly how open and avowed this was. It was conceded at trial that she had an ongoing fiduciary duty to care for her mother, and she continued to do so in spite of a court order that she stop. So that simply shows that this was an open and avowed taking of the money under her good faith claim of title under the durable power of attorney agreement.
How can she have a good faith claim of title after the court has told her to not access that money anymore?
Because she knew she still had...
She knew that, I take it.
Yes, she did. But she also knew that she still had a duty to take care of her mother's affairs. So she was essentially caught in a conflict. You've got her fiduciary duty under the durable power of attorney agreement and the court's order, and she opted to take care of her mother. That may have been the wrong choice, but it doesn't prove that, you know, she was committing theft. It doesn't prove her intent to deprive her mother, and it doesn't disprove her good faith claim of title. So she was clearly prejudiced by her counsel's failure to object to these arguments, because it essentially deprived her of the benefit of her defense. Under the prosecutor's argument, if she breached this fiduciary duty under the durable power of attorney agreement with objectively unreasonable choices or failing to provide an accounting, then she's sort of automatically guilty of theft, regardless of her good faith claim, regardless of her intent. If the jury had actually carefully inquired into the intent, despite the evidence of breach, then there were certainly valid reasons to find a reasonable doubt. And there is a reasonable probability, which is the standard under Strickland and Thomas, that the outcome of the trial would have been different. So we ask the court to reverse.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Erin Becker on behalf of the respondent, the state of Washington. During a 10-month period, while her mother was hospitalized and mentally incapacitated due to dementia, Ms. Knopp withdrew over $23,000 from her mother's bank accounts. Nearly all of that was withdrawn in untraceable cash, much of it from casinos, and much of that in multiple withdrawals on the same day, incurring cumulative ATM fees. Just in the period from June to October of 2009 alone, when the court had put in place a blocking order while they investigated these unauthorized withdrawals or whether these withdrawals were unauthorized, Knopp withdrew another $7,000 of that $23,000. She never told the court she was doing so. She never applied to the court for permission to do so. To the extent counsel suggests that she had conflicting duties, there's no evidence that she asked the court to resolve those duties for her. The court instituted a blocking order and told her not to use the accounts. She also failed to produce an accounting during that period. She was required to do so by the durable power of attorney, and three different people requested it from her: the guardian ad litem, Adult Protective Services, and the police department. The King County Superior Court then ordered her to produce an accounting on multiple occasions. She failed to do so. Under these circumstances, the defendant cannot show that any taking of Maria Volz's money in multiple withdrawals of cash at ATMs at casinos was an open and avowed taking. So even if this court were to find that there was prosecutorial misconduct or was to find that that counsel's performance in failing to object was deficient, the fact that these takings were not open and not avowed defeats the defense of good faith claim of title, and there is no prejudice.
What do you think open and avowed means?
Well, at the very least, during the period of the blocking order, it has to mean creating the accounting that she's been ordered repeatedly to do so, telling the court that she's doing so, or asking the court for permission to do so. She did none of those things. Certainly on a day-to-day basis leading up to June of 2009, or more accurately leading up to April before the guardian ad litem got involved and asked for an accounting in the first instance, something more informal might be appropriate. Retaining receipts, getting copies of her mother's bank accounts, having some reflection. She finally produced what she claimed was an accounting on the eve of the trial, which was about 3 years later. To call that an accounting would completely misconstrue the word accounting. It has almost no information in it. It's a short list of what she claims to have spent money on during a very limited period that was involved. And during that period, she did not reflect the withdrawals. She did not reflect how much money she was paying herself. It's just a listing of claimed expenses. And that's aside...
Failure to provide an accounting isn't an element of the crime of theft.
Correct.
Nor is it particularly a defense. So I don't know why we're all mired in that. It has to do with whether or not she believed, if you will, that she was owed this money. The fact she took it out in $50 increments, that's not even relevant. So there is, the way this case was presented by the prosecution is troublesome, both in argument and from the standpoint of, and this is not an easy statute when you get into these, I know that. But when you throw everything at the wall like this, it becomes difficult to look through it and find out just where this occurred. I'm sure this person doesn't know what accounting means.
And I think you're correct. She probably doesn't know what an accounting means, but she provided no information at all. And certainly, whether she provides an accounting or not...
Did she provide a defense is the question.
Exactly. And I would invite this court just to look at the period of June to October when she was explicitly told by the court, and there was an order in effect saying, you can't withdraw money from this account, period. You're allowed to write exactly one check to group health to pay for your mother's premiums, which she did. But she also repeatedly withdrew money. And even if she doesn't write an accounting, I think an accounting is one thing to look at whether this is an open and avowed taking. Certainly it's not an element, but it's relevant to whether there's any evidence to support the defense of good faith claim of title. And given that she didn't do that when required to, ordered to, asked to repeatedly, and didn't do anything else, like keep receipts, keep track of anything, ask the court for permission to spend the money.
Other than being in contempt of the court, your argument is going too far, so you're inviting me to do this.
Okay.
Other than establishing contempt of court, all that does is establish unauthorized control. You're still left with the question of an intent to deprive. So it may well be that with regard to intent to deprive, then this is where the good faith claim of title would come in. It's one of the things. But you also have to prove intent. And if you have somebody that doesn't really know what they're doing and they're in over their heads, at what point do you cross that threshold from mere negligence, if you will, even gross negligence, all of which are lower standards, if you will, than intent to deprive? Did we confuse that in this case?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And I would say a couple things. One is that the good faith claim of title defense obviously specifically goes to negate the intent to deprive. And I think that all of that evidence regarding where the money is being withdrawn and how it is being withdrawn is relevant to intent to deprive. Because if you think that you're owed $500 by your mother, or let's take $300, which is a common ATM limit per day. If you think your mother owes you $300, then you might go to an ATM and take out $300, but you're not going to take out $100 and then another $100 and then another $100, incurring, you know, over a three-hour period, incurring $9.
You are if you're addicted to gambling. That doesn't necessarily prove anything other than you're addicted to gambling. Again, it's very, very tangential to the intent element, if you will. All you're showing is that she did it on a number of occasions. What is the defense to this case? I think the statute needs a little work legislatively, to tell you the truth.
I won't disagree with you there.
It's not good.
Right.
Can I ask you to address the prosecutorial misconduct claims?
Certainly, Your Honor. Pardon me?
That's where I was going with.
Certainly, I would note a couple of things. I went through in my brief, and I don't have the time to do that at this point, to go through each of their particular claims. But I would ask the court to take a look at the claimed statement and the claim that it is misconduct, and put it in the context of what is being argued at the particular moment.
It was at least an argument that by breaching her fiduciary duty, I mean almost an explicit argument that by breaching her fiduciary duty, she was committing a crime.
Certainly those words are there, but when put in context, as the case law requires the court to do in evaluating whether a statement is improper, if you look at the context, for example, the very first one that is pointed out by counsel is at RP 10:14-16 and discusses this failure to fulfill a fiduciary duty can constitute a crime. Her very next sentence is that we know that Knopp stole from her mother. So she is tying that specifically to the idea of theft. And although she is making a broader statement than is appropriate with respect to breach of fiduciary duty may be a crime, she's then immediately saying, and what we know here is that the defendant stole from her mother and is making
that's
that specific.
Exactly the issue that you're on trial for. So that statement begs the question. That's simply to say, I think she's guilty.
But she's saying it specifically. She's not saying a breach of fiduciary duty is a crime. She's saying more specifically that this theft is a crime and not just a breach of fiduciary duty. And I would ask the court to look at the other ones in context as well. I'd point out further that there's no objection, and that the fact that counsel doesn't object should suggest to this court, applying the presumption of effectiveness, as this court is required to do, the counsel didn't see anything particularly wrong with the statements that were being made in closing argument.
If you get to the prejudice prong of Strickland, though, are you arguing the only way you get past that is there was overwhelming evidence that this was not open and avowed?
There's zero evidence that was open and avowed, and you can't avail yourself of the defense if it's not an open and avowed taking. So even setting aside the deficient performance, setting aside whether the argument was...
What does that mean?
I'm saying...
Open and avowed. I mean, again, that's another term in this statute that's absolutely impossible of definition. She did it. She took it out of a bank.
She did.
It's action that's recorded. I mean, I'm sure a picture was taken while she's doing it. How more open can you be?
And I'd point the court again to the 3-month period when there was a blocking order and she was told, don't take cash out of this account. And she took another $7,000 without telling the court or asking the court for permission.
That doesn't mean it's not open and avowed. It just means it's contemptuous. In other words, it's a different thing. It's a different element. And what we're doing here is conflating all this, which is what troubles me.
Well, the state respectfully disagrees, but nevertheless asks this court to affirm.
A lot of people in trouble who don't necessarily need to be there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll start by just pointing, Your Honor, in terms of the argument to page 1015 of the report of proceedings, where the prosecutor stated, we as a society decided to make it a crime not to fulfill that duty. And that type of statement was repeated over and over again. That is a misstatement of the law. And this was an open and avowed taking. Open simply means you didn't hide it. Avowed simply means you admitted it when you were asked. And both of those things are true in this case. at page 694 through 696 of the trial, they talked about how her past pattern of spending did not change even after she knew she was under investigation. That shows that this is an open and avowed taking. As soon as the officers approached her and asked her about these withdrawals,
it might show that she had an intent to deprive. In other words, if you take the whole thing in context, which we do when you raise an ineffective assistance, it may well be it all just disappears into the morass of evidence here with regard to her intent to deprive and the act of depriving. Gambling is a little far afield from exercising your duties as the guardian of your parents' estate.
Certainly, Your Honor. But the fact that she withdrew it at the casino is something she openly admitted. And as soon as she was asked...
But her claim of right is really contingent on her using the money for certain purposes, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And without using, if the state shows that she's not using the money for those purposes, then her claim of right disappears, and they've disproved the defense, have they not?
They have, if they have proved that it was not something that she believed was in her mother's best interest under the durable power of attorney. It's essentially a subjective standard, this good faith belief. And so just because the court or the attorney or the police might dispute her priorities, that doesn't, and might decide that's objectively unreasonable, that doesn't necessarily make it intent to deprive.
Part of her priority is gambling.
But if, yes, Your Honor, if it's absolutely proved that it was spent on gambling, then we agree.
Thank you.
Thank you.